Side 5. Nightfall and Other Stories by Isaac Asimov. Continuing with Sea Shoot on page 150.
I won't bother with you because you're a bag of nothing but noisy air. But wait, someday you'll blow your air in one face too many, and it will be let out of you.
I'll wait, said Stuart. Wyndham hobbled over, leaning heavily on his cane.
Now, now, he called with a wheezing joviality that overlaid his sweating anxiety so thinly as to emphasize it. We're all Earthmen, dash it. Got to remember that. Keep it as a glowing light of inspiration. Never let down before the blasted Chloros. We've got to forget private feuds and remember only that we are Earthmen united against alien blighters.
Stuart's comment was unprintable. Porter was right behind Wyndham. He had been in a close conference with the shaven-headed colonel for an hour, and now he said with indignation,
It doesn't help to be a wise guy, Stuart. You listen to the colonel. We've been doing some hard thinking about the situation.
He had washed some of the grease off his face, wet his hair, and slicked it back. It did not remove the little tick on his right cheek just at the point where his lips ended, or make his hangnail hands more attractive in appearance.
All right, Colonel, said Stuart. What's on your mind?
Wyndham said,
I'd prefer to have all the men together.
Okay, call them.
LeBlanc hurried over. Mullen approached with greater deliberation. Stuart said,
You want that fellow?
He jerked his head at Polyorcetes.
Why, yes, Mr. Polyorcetes, may we have you, old fella?
Ah, leave me alone.
Go ahead, said Stuart. Leave him alone. I don't want him.
No, no, said Wyndham. This is a matter for all Earthmen. Mr. Polyorcetes, we must have you.
Polyorcetes rolled off one side of his cot.
I'm close enough. I can hear you.
Wyndham said to Stuart,
Would they, the Chloros, I mean, have this room wired?
No, said Stuart. Why should they?
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. They didn't know what happened when Polyorcetes jumped me. They just heard the thumping when it started rattling the ship.
Maybe they were trying to give us the impression the room wasn't wired.
Listen, Colonel, I've never known a Chloro to tell a deliberate lie.
Polyorcetes interrupted calmly.
That lump of noise just loves the Chloros.
Wyndham said hastily,
Let's not begin that. Look, Stuart, Porter and I have been discussing matters, and we have decided that you know the Chloros well enough to think of some way of getting us back to Earth.
It happens that you're wrong. I can't think of any way.
Maybe there is some way we can take the ship back from the blasted green fellas, suggested Wyndham. Some weakness they may have. Dash it, you know what I mean.
Tell me, Colonel, what are you after, your own skin or Earth's welfare?
I resent that question. I'll have you know that while I'm as careful of my own life as anyone has a right to be, I'm thinking of Earth primarily, and I think that's true of all of us.
Damn right, said Porter instantly.
LeBlanc looked anxious, Polyorcetes resentful, and Mullen had no expression at all.
Good, said Stuart. Of course, I don't think we can take the ship. They're armed and we aren't, but there's this. You know why the Chloros took this ship intact? It's because they need ships. They may be better chemists than Earthmen are, but Earthmen are better astronautical engineers. We have bigger, better, and more ships. In fact, if our crew had had a proper respect for military axioms in the first place, they would have blown the ship up as soon as it looked as though the Chloros were going to board.
LeBlanc looked horrified.
And kill the passengers? Why not? You heard what the good colonel said. Every one of us puts his own lousy little life after Earth's interests. What good are we to Earth alive right now? None at all. What harm will this ship do in Chloro hands? A hell of a lot, probably.
Just why, asked Mullen, did our men refuse to blow up the ship? They must have had a reason.
They did. It's the firmest tradition of Earth's military men that there must never be an unfavorable ratio of casualties. If we had blown ourselves up, 20 fighting men and 7 civilians of Earth would be dead, as compared with an enemy casualty total of 0. So what happens? We let them board, kill 28, I'm sure we killed at least that many, and let them have the ship.
Talk, 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 jeered Polyorcetes.
There's a moral to this, said Stuart. We can't take the ship away from the Chloros. We might be able to rush them, though, and keep them busy long enough to allow one of us enough time to short the engines.
What? Yelled Porter, and Wyndham shushed him in fright.
Short the engines, Stuart repeated. That would destroy the ship, of course, which is what we want to do, isn't it?
LeBlanc's lips were white.
I don't think that would work.
We can't be sure till we try, but what have we to lose by trying?
Our lives, damn it, cried Porter. You insane maniac, you're crazy.
If I'm a maniac, said Stuart, and insane to boot, then naturally I'm crazy. But just remember that if we lose our lives, which is overwhelmingly probable, we lose nothing of value to Earth, whereas if we destroy the ship, as we just barely might, we do Earth a lot of good. What patriot would hesitate? Who here would put himself ahead of his world?
He looked about in the silence. Surely not you, Colonel Wyndham.
Wyndham coughed tremendously. My dear man, that is not the question. There must be a way to save the ship for Earth without losing our lives, eh?
All right, you name it.
Let's all think about it. Now, there are only two of the Chloros aboard ship. If one of us could sneak up on them and...
How? The rest of the ship's all filled with chlorine. We'd have to wear a spacesuit. Gravity in that part of the ship is hopped up to chloro level, so whoever is Patsy in the deal would be clumping around, metal on metal, slow and heavy. Oh, he could sneak up on them, sure, like a skunk trying to sneak downwind.
Then we'll drop it all, Porter's voice shook. Listen, Wyndham, there's not going to be any destroying the ship. My life means plenty to me, and if any of you try anything like that, I'll call the Chloros. I mean it.
Well, said Stuart, there's hero number one.
LeBlanc said, I want to go back to Earth, but I...
Mullen interrupted. I don't think our chances of destroying the ship are good enough unless...
Heroes number two and three, what about you, Polyarchides? You would have the chance of killing two Chloros.
I want to kill them with my bare hands, growled the farmer, his heavy fists writhing. On their planet, I will kill dozens.
That's a nice, safe promise for now. What about you, Colonel? Don't you want to march to death and glory with me?
Your attitude is very cynical and unbecoming, Stuart. It's obvious that if the rest are unwilling, then your plan will fall through.
Unless I do it myself, huh?
You won't, do you hear? Said Porter instantly.
Damn right I won't, agreed Stuart. I don't claim to be a hero. I'm just an average patriot, perfectly willing to head for any planet they take me to and sit out the war.
Mullen said thoughtfully, Of course, there is a way we could surprise the Chloros.
The statement would have dropped flat except for Polyarchides. He pointed a black-nailed, stubby forefinger and laughed harshly.
Mr. Bookkeeper, he said, Mr. Bookkeeper is a big-shot talker like this damned greeny spy Stuart. All right, Mr. Bookkeeper, go ahead. You make big speeches also. Let the words roll like an empty barrel.
He turned to Stuart and repeated venomously, Empty barrel, cripple hand, empty barrel, no good for anything but talk.
Mullins's soft voice could make no headway until Polyarchides was through, but then he said, speaking directly to Stuart,
We might be able to reach them from outside. This room has a sea chute, I'm sure.
What's a sea chute? Asked LeBlanc.
Well, began Mullen, and then stopped at a loss.
Stuart said mockingly, It's a euphemism, my boy. Its full name is casualty chute. It doesn't get talked about, but the main rooms on any ship would have them. They're just little airlocks down which you slide a corpse. Burial at space. Always lots of sentiment and bowed heads, with the captain making a rolling speech of the type Polyarchides here wouldn't like.
LeBlanc's face twisted. Use that to leave the ship?
Why not? Superstitious? Go on, Mullen.
The little man had waited patiently. He said, Once outside, one could re-enter the ship by the steam tubes. It can be done with luck. And then you would be an unexpected visitor in the control room.
Stuart stared at him curiously. How do you figure this out? What do you know about steam tubes?
Mullen coughed. You mean
Because I'm in the paper box business?
Well, he grew pink, waited a moment, then made a new start in a colorless, unemotional voice.
My company, which manufactures fancy paper boxes and novelty containers, made a line of spaceship candy boxes for the juvenile trade some years ago. It was designed so that if a string were pulled, small pressure containers were punctured and jets of compressed air shot out through the mock steam tubes, sailing the box across the room and scattering candy as it went. The sales theory was that the youngsters would find it exciting to play with the ship and fun to scramble for the candy. Actually, it was a complete failure. The ship would break dishes and sometimes hit another child in the eye. Worse still, the children would not only scramble for the candy, but would fight over it. It was almost our worst failure. We lost thousands. Still, while the boxes were being designed, the entire office was extremely interested. It was like a game, very bad for efficiency and office morale. For a while, we all became steam tube experts. I read quite a few books on ship construction, on my own time, however, not the company's.
Stuart was intrigued. He said, "You know, it's a video sort of idea, but it might work if we had a hero to spare, have we?"
"What about you?"
demanded Porter indignantly. "You go around sneering at us with your cheap wisecracks. I don't notice you volunteering for anything." "That's because I'm no hero, Porter, I admit it. My object is to stay alive, and shinnying down steam tubes is no way to go about staying alive. But the rest of you are noble patriots. The Colonel says so. What about you, Colonel? You're the senior hero here."
Wyndham said, "If I were younger, blessed it, and if you had your hands, I would take pleasure, sir, in trouncing you soundly."
"I've no doubt of it, but that's no answer."
"You know very well that at my time of life and with my leg," he brought the flat of his hand down upon his stiff knee, "I am in no position to do anything of the sort, however much I should wish to."
"Ah, yes," said Stuart, "and I myself am crippled in the hands, as Polyorcides tells me. That saves us. And what unfortunate deformities do the rest of us have?"
"Listen," cried Porter, "I want to know what this is all about. How can anyone go down the steam tubes? What if the Chloros use them while one of us is inside?"
"Why, Porter, that's part of the sporting chance. It's where the excitement comes in."
"But he'd be boiled in the shell like a lobster."
"A pretty image, but inaccurate. The steam wouldn't be on for more than a very short time, maybe a second or two, and the suit insulation would hold that long. Besides, the jet comes scooting out at several hundred miles a minute, so that you would be blown clear of the ship before the steam could even warm you. In fact, you'd be blown quite a few miles out into space, and after that, you would be quite safe from the Chloros. Of course, you couldn't get back to the ship."
Porter was sweating freely.
"You don't scare me for 1 minute, Stuart."
"I don't?"
"Then you're offering to go? Are you sure you've thought out what being stranded in space means? You're all alone, you know, really all alone. The steam jet will probably leave you turning or tumbling pretty rapidly. You won't feel that. You'll seem to be motionless, but all the stars will be going around and around so that they're just streaks in the sky. They won't ever stop. They won't even slow up. Then your heater will go off, your oxygen will give out, and you will die very slowly. You'll have lots of time to think, or if you were in a hurry, you could open your suit. That wouldn't be pleasant either. I've seen faces of men who had a torn suit happen to them accidentally, and it's pretty awful. But it would be quicker. Then..." Porter turned and walked unsteadily away. Stuart said lightly, "Another failure. One act of heroism, still ready to be knocked down to the highest bidder with nothing offered yet."
Polyorcides spoke up, and his harsh voice roughed the words.
"You keep on talking, Mr. Big Mouth. You just keep banging that empty barrel. Pretty soon we'll kick your teeth in. There's one boy I think would be willing to do it now, eh, Mr. Porter?"
Porter's look at Stuart confirmed the truth of Polyorcides' remarks, but he said nothing.
Stuart said, "Then what about you, Polyorcides? You're the bare-hand man with guts. Want me to help you into a suit?"
"I'll ask you when I want help."
"What about you, LeBlanc?" The young man shrank away.
"Not even to get back to Margaret?"
But LeBlanc could only shake his head.
Mullen? Well, I'll try.
You'll what?
I said, yes, I'll try. After all, it's my idea.
Stuart looked stunned. You serious? How come?
Mullen's prim mouth pursed. Because no one else will.
But that's no reason, especially for you, Mullen shrugged.
There was a thump of a cane behind Stuart. Wyndham brushed past. He said,
Do you really intend to go, Mullen?
Yes, Colonel.
In that case, dash it. Let me shake your hand. I like you. You're an Earthman, by heaven. Do this, and win or die, I'll bear witness for you.
Mullen withdrew his hand awkwardly from the deep and vibrating grasp of the other. And Stuart just stood there. He was in a very unusual position. He was, in fact, in the particular position of all positions in which he most rarely found himself. He had nothing to say. The quality of tension had changed. The gloom and frustration had lifted a bit, and the excitement of conspiracy had replaced it. Even Polyorcetes was fingering the spacesuits and commenting briefly and hoarsely on which he considered preferable. Mullen was having a certain amount of trouble. The suit hung rather limply upon him, even though the adjustable joints had been tightened nearly to minimum. He stood there now with only the helmet to be screwed on. He wiggled his neck. Stuart was holding the helmet with an effort. It was heavy, and his artoplasmic hands did not grip it well. He said, Better scratch your nose if it itches. It's your last chance for a while. He didn't add maybe forever, but he thought it. Mullen said tonelessly, I think perhaps I had better have a spare oxygen cylinder. Good enough. With a reducing valve. Stuart nodded. I see what you're thinking of. If you do get blown clear of the ship, you could try to blow yourself back by using the cylinder as an action-reaction motor. They clamped on the headpiece and buckled the spare cylinder to Mullen's waist. Polyorcetes and LeBlanc lifted him up to the yawning opening of the C-tube. It was ominously dark inside, the metal lining of the interior having been painted a mournful black. Stuart thought he could detect a musty odor about it, but that, he knew, was only imagination. He stopped the proceedings when Mullen was half within the tube. He tapped upon the little man's faceplate.
Can you hear me?
Within there was a nod.
Air coming through all right? No last-minute troubles?
Mullen lifted his armored arm in a gesture of reassurance.
And then remember, don't use the suit radio out there. The Claros might pick up the signals.
Reluctantly, he stepped away. Polyorcetes' brawny hands lowered Mullen until they could hear the thumping sound made by the steel-shod feet against the outer valve. The inner valve then swung shut with a dreadful finality, its beveled silicone gasket making a slight suffing noise as it crushed hard. They clamped it into place. Stuart stood at the toggle switch that controlled the outer valve. He threw it, and the gauge that marked the air pressure within the tube fell to zero. A little pinpoint of red light warned that the outer valve was open. Then the light disappeared, the valve closed, and the gauge climbed slowly to 15 pounds again. They opened the inner valve again and found the tube empty. Polyorcetes spoke first. He said,
The little son of a gun. He went.
He looked wonderingly at the others.
A little fellow with guts like that.
Stuart said, Look, we'd better get ready in here. There's just a chance that the Claros may have detected the valves opening and closing. If so, they'll be here to investigate, and we'll have to cover up.
How?
Asked Wyndham.
They won't see Mullen anywhere around. We'll say he's in the head.
The Claros know that it's one of the peculiar characteristics of Earthmen that they resent intrusion on their privacy in lavatories, and they'll make no effort to check. If we can hold them off...
What if they wait? Or if they check the spacesuits? Asked Porter.
Stuart shrugged.
Let's hope they don't, and listen, Polyorcetes, don't make any fuss when they come in.
Polyorcetes grunted.
With that little guy out there, what do you think I am?
He stared at Stuart without animosity, then scratched his curly hair vigorously.
You know, I laughed at him. I thought he was an old woman. It makes me ashamed.
Stuart cleared his throat. He said,
Look, I've been saying some things that maybe weren't too funny after all, now that I come to think of it. I'd like to say I'm sorry if I have.
He turned away morosely and walked toward his cot. He heard the steps behind him, felt the touch on his sleeve. He turned. It was LeBlanc. The youngster said softly,
"I keep thinking that Mr. Mullen is an old man."
"Well, he's not a kid. He's about 45 or 50, I think." LeBlanc said,
"Do you think, Mr. Stewart, that I should have gone instead? I'm the youngest here. I don't like the thought of having let an old man go in my place. It makes me feel like the devil.
I know. If he dies, it will be too bad."
"But he volunteered. We didn't make him, did we?"
"Don't try to dodge responsibility, LeBlanc. It won't make you feel better. There isn't one of us without a stronger motive to run the risk than he had." And Stewart sat there silent with thinking. Mullen felt the obstruction beneath his feet yield and the walls about him slip away quickly, too quickly. He knew it was the puff of air escaping, carrying him with it, and he dug arms and legs frantically against the wall to break himself. Corpses were supposed to be flung well clear of the ship, but he was no corpse for the moment. His feet swung free and threshed. He heard the clunk of one magnetic boot against the hull just as the rest of his body puffed out like a tight cork under air pressure. He teetered dangerously at the lip of the hole in the ship. He had changed orientation suddenly and was looking down on it, then took a step backward as its lid came down of itself and fitted smoothly against the hull. A feeling of unreality overwhelmed him. Surely it wasn't he standing on the outer surface of a ship, not Randolph F. Mullen. So few human beings could ever say they had, even those who traveled in space constantly. He was only gradually aware that he was in pain. Popping out of that hole with one foot clamped to the hull had nearly bent him in two. He tried moving cautiously and found his motions to be erratic and almost impossible to control. He thought nothing was broken, though the muscles of his left side were badly wrenched. And then he came to himself and noticed that the wrist lights of his suit were on. It was by their light that he had stared into the blackness of the sea chute. He stirred with the nervous thought that from within, the Chloros might see the twin spots of moving light just outside the hull. He flicked the switch upon the suit's midsection. Mullen had never imagined that, standing on a ship, he would fail to see its hull, but it was dark. As dark below as above. And there were the stars, hard and bright little non-dimensional dots. Nothing more anywhere. Under his feet, not even the stars, not even his feet. He bent back to look at the stars. His head swam. They were moving slowly, or rather, they were standing still, and the ship was rotating, but he could not tell his eyes that. They moved. His eyes followed down and behind the ship. New stars up and above from the other side, a black horizon. The ship existed only as a region where there were no stars. No stars? Why, there was one almost at his feet. He nearly reached for it. Then he realized that it was only a glittering reflection in the mirroring metal. They were moving thousands of miles an hour. The stars were, the ship was, he was, but it meant nothing. To his senses, there was only silence and darkness, and that slow wheeling of the stars. His eyes followed the wheeling, and his head in its helmet hit the ship's hull with a soft, bell-like ring. He felt about in panic with his thick, insensitive, spun silicate gloves. His feet were still firmly magnetized to the hull, that was true, but the rest of his body bent backward at the knees in a right angle. There was no gravity outside the ship. If he bent back, there was nothing to pull the upper part of his body down until his joints they were bending. His body stayed as he put it. He pressed wildly against the hull, and his torso shot upward and refused to stop when upright. He fell forward. He tried more slowly, balancing with both hands against the hull until he squatted evenly. Then upward, very slowly, straight up, arms out to balance. He was straight now, aware of his nausea and lightheadedness. He looked about. My God, where were the steam tubes? He couldn't see them. They were black on black, nothing on nothing. Quickly, he turned on the wrist lights. In space, there were no beams, only elliptical, sharply defined spots of blue steel winking light back at him. where they struck a rivet, a shadow was cast, knife-sharp and as black as space. The lighted region illuminated abruptly and without diffusion. He moved his arms, his body swaying gently in the opposite direction, action and reaction. The vision of a steam tube with its smooth, cylindrical sides sprang at him. He tried to move toward it, his foot held firmly to the hull. He pulled, and it slogged upward, straining against quicksand that eased quickly. 3 inches up, and it had almost sucked free. 6 inches up, and he thought it would fly away. He advanced it and let it down, felt it enter the quicksand. When the sole was within 2 inches of the hull, it snapped down, out of control, hitting the hull ringingly. His spacesuit carried the vibrations, amplifying them in his ears. He stopped in absolute terror. The dehydrators that dried the atmosphere within his suit could not handle the sudden gush of perspiration that drenched his forehead and armpits. He waited, then tried lifting his foot again, a bare inch, holding it there by main force and moving it horizontally. Horizontal motion involved no effort at all. It was motion perpendicular to the lines of magnetic force. But he had to keep the foot from snapping down as he did so, and then lower it slowly. He puffed with the effort. Each step was agony. The tendons of his knees were cracking, and there were knives in his side. Mullins stopped to let the perspiration dry. It wouldn't do to steam up the inside of his faceplate. He flashed his wrist lights, and the steam cylinder was right ahead. The ship had four of them at 90-degree intervals, thrusting out at an angle from the mid-girdle. They were the fine adjustment of the ship's course. The course adjustment was the powerful thrusters back and front, which fixed final velocity by their accelerative and decelerative force. And the hyperatomics that took care of the space-swallowing jumps. But occasionally the direction of flight had to be adjusted slightly, and then the steam cylinders took over. Singly, they could drive the ship up, down, right, left. By twos, in appropriate ratios of thrust, the ship could be turned in any desired direction. The device had been unimproved in centuries, being too simple to improve. The atomic pile heated the water content of a closed container into steam, driving it, in less than a second, up to temperatures where it would have broken down into a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, and then into a mixture of electrons and ions. Perhaps the breakdown actually took place. No one ever bothered testing. It worked, so there was no need to. At the critical point, a needle valve gave way, and the steam thrust madly out in a short but incredible blast. And the ship, inevitably and majestically, moved in the opposite direction, veering about its own center of gravity. When the degrees of turn were sufficient, an equal and opposite blast would take place, and the turning would be canceled. The ship would be moving at its original velocity, but in a new direction. Mullen had dragged himself out to the lip of the steam cylinder. He had a picture of himself, a small speck teetering at the extreme end of a structure thrusting out of an ovoid that was tearing through space at 10,000 miles an hour. But there was no airstream to whip him off the hull, and his magnetic soles held him more firmly than he liked. With lights on, he bent down to peer into the tube, and the ship dropped down precipitously as his orientation changed. He reached out to steady himself, but he was not falling. There was no up or down in space except for what his confused mind chose to consider up or down. The cylinder was just large enough to hold a man so that it might be entered for repair purposes. His light caught the rungs almost directly opposite his position at the lip. He puffed a sigh of relief with what breath he could muster. Some ships didn't have ladders. He made his way to it, the ship appearing to slip and twist beneath him as he moved. He lifted an arm over the lip of the tube, feeling for the rung, loosened each foot, and drew himself within. The knot in his stomach that had been there from the first was a convulsed agony now. If they should choose to manipulate the ship, if the steam should whistle out now, he would never hear it, never know it. One instant he would be holding a rung, feeling slowly for the next with a groping arm. The next moment, he would be alone in space, the ship a dark, dark nothingness lost forever among the stars. There would be, perhaps, a brief glory of swirling ice crystals drifting with him, shining in his wrist lights, and slowly approaching and rotating about him, attracted by his mass like infinitesimal planets to an absurdly tiny sun. He was trickling sweat again, and now he was also conscious of thirst. He put it out of his mind. There would be no drinking until he was out of his suit, if ever. Up a rung, up another, and another. How many were there? His hand slipped, and he stared in disbelief at the glitter that showed under his light. Ice? Why not? The steam, incredibly hot as it was, would strike metal that was at nearly absolute zero. In the few split seconds of thrust, there would not be time for the metal to warm above the freezing point of water. A sheet of ice would condense that would sublime slowly into the vacuum. It was the speed of all that happened that prevented the fusion of the tubes and of the original water container itself. His groping hand reached the end. Again the wrist lights. He stared with crawling horror at the steam nozzle, half an inch in diameter. It looked dead, harmless. But it always would, right up to the microsecond before. Around it was the outer steam lock. It pivoted on a central hub that was springed on the portion toward space, screwed on the part toward the ship. The springs allowed it to give under the first wild thrust of steam pressure before the ship's mighty inertia could be overcome. The steam was bled into the inner chamber, breaking the force of the thrust, leaving the total energy unchanged, but spreading it over time so that the hull itself was in that much less danger of being staved in. Mullen braced himself firmly against a rung and pressed against the outer lock so that it gave a little. It was stiff, but it didn't have to give much, just enough to catch on the screw. He felt it catch. He strained against it and turned it, feeling his body twist in the opposite direction. It held tight, the screw taking up the strain as he carefully adjusted the small control switch that allowed the springs to fall free. How well he remembered the books he had read. He was in the interlock space now, which was large enough to hold a man comfortably, again for convenience in repairs. He could no longer be blown away from the ship. If the steam blast were turned on now, it would merely drive him against the inner lock, hard enough to crush him to a pulp. A quick death he would never feel, at least. Slowly, he unhooked his spare oxygen cylinder. There was only an inner lock between himself and the control room now. This lock opened outward into space so that the steam blast could only close it tighter rather than blow it open, and it fitted tightly and smoothly. There was absolutely no way to open it from without. He lifted himself above the lock, forcing his bent back against the inner surface of the interlock area. It made breathing difficult. The spare oxygen cylinder dangled at a queer angle. He held its metal mesh hose and straightened it, forcing it against the inner lock so that vibration thudded. Again. Again. It would have to attract the attention of the Chloros. They would have to investigate. He would have no way of telling when they were about to do so. Ordinarily, they would first let air into the interlock to force the outer lock shut. But now the outer lock was on the central screw, well away from its rim. Air would suck about it ineffectually, dragging out into space. Mullen kept on thumping. Would the Chloros look at the air gauge, note that it scarcely lifted from zero, or would they take its proper working for granted? Porter said, "He's been gone an hour and a half." "I know," said Stuart. They were all restless, jumpy, but the tension among themselves had disappeared. It was as though all the threads of emotion extended to the hull of the ship. Porter was bothered. His philosophy of life had always been simple. Take care of yourself, because no one will take care of you for you. It upset him to see it shaken. He said, "Do you suppose they've caught him?" "If they had, we'd hear about it," replied Stuart briefly. Porter felt, with a miserable twinge, that there was little interest on the part of the others in speaking to him. He could understand it. He had not exactly earned their respect. For the moment, a torrent of self-excuse poured through his mind. The others had been frightened, too. A man had a right to be afraid. No one likes to die. At least he hadn't broken like Aristides Polyarchides. He hadn't wept like LeBlanc. But there was Mullen out there on the hull. "Listen," he cried. "Why did he do it?" They turned to look at him, not understanding, but Porter didn't care. It bothered him to the point where it had to come out. "I want to know why Mullen is risking his life." "The man," said Wyndham,
is a patriot. No, none of that. Porter was almost hysterical. That little fellow has no emotions at all. He just has reasons. And I want to know what those reasons are, because... He didn't finish the sentence. Could he say that if those reasons applied to a little middle-aged bookkeeper, they might apply even more forcibly to himself? Polyarchates said, "He's one brave, damn little fellow." Porter got to his feet. "Listen," he said. "He may be stuck out there. Whatever he's doing, he may not be able to finish it alone. I volunteer to go out after him." He was shaking as he said it, and he waited in fear for the sarcastic lash of Stuart's tongue. Stuart was staring at him, probably with surprise, but Porter dared not meet his eyes to make certain. Stuart said mildly, "Let's give him another half hour." Porter looked up, startled. There was no sneer on Stuart's face. It was even friendly. They all looked friendly. He said, "And then?" "And then all those who do volunteer will draw straws or something equally democratic. Who volunteers besides Porter?" They all raised their hands. Stuart did, too. But Porter was happy. He had volunteered first. He was anxious for the half hour to pass. It caught Mullen by surprise. The outer lock flew open, and the long, thin, snake-like, almost headless neck of a chloro sucked out, unable to fight the blast of escaping air. Mullen's cylinder flew away, almost tore free. After one wild moment of frozen panic, he fought for it, dragging it above the airstream, waiting as long as he dared to let the first fury die down as the air of the control room thinned out, then bringing it down with force. It caught the sinewy neck squarely, crushing it. Mullen curled above the lock, almost entirely protected from the stream, raised the cylinder again, and plunging it down again, striking the head, mashing the staring eyes to liquid ruin. In the near vacuum, green blood was pumping out of what was left of the neck. Mullen dared not vomit, but he wanted to. With eyes averted, he backed away, caught the outer lock with one hand, and imparted a whirl. For several seconds, it maintained that whirl. At the end of the screw, the springs engaged automatically and pulled it shut. What was left of the atmosphere tightened it, and the laboring pumps could now begin to fill the control room once again. Mullen crawled over the mangled chloro and into the room. It was empty. He had barely time to notice that when he found himself on his knees. He rose with difficulty. The transition from non-gravity to gravity had taken him entirely by surprise. It was chlorine gravity, too, which meant that with this suit, he carried a 50% overload for his small frame. At least, though, his heavy metal clogs no longer clung so exasperatingly to the metal underneath. Within the ship, floors and wall were of cork-covered aluminum alloy. He circled slowly. The necklace chloro had collapsed and lay with only an occasional twitch to show it had once been a living organism. He stepped over it distastefully and drew the steam tube lock shut. The room had a depressing bilious cast, and the lights shone yellow-green. It was the chloro atmosphere, of course. Mullen felt a twinge of surprise and reluctant admiration. The chloros obviously had some way of treating materials so that they were impervious to the oxidizing effect of chlorine. Even the map of Earth on the wall, printed on glossy plastic-backed paper, seemed fresh and untouched. He approached, drawn by the familiar outlines of the continents. There was a flash of motion caught in the corner of his eyes. As quickly as he could in his heavy suit, he turned, then screamed. The chloro he had thought dead was rising to its feet. Its neck hung limp, an oozing mass of tissue mash, but its arms reached out blindly, and the tentacles about its chest vibrated rapidly like innumerable snakes' tongues. It was blind, of course. The destruction of its neck stalk had deprived it of all sensory equipment, and partial asphyxiation had disorganized it, but the brain remained whole and safe in the abdomen. It still lived. Mullen backed away. He circled, trying clumsily and unsuccessfully to tiptoe, though he knew that what was left of the chloro was also death. It blundered on its way, struck a wall, felt to the base, and began sidling along it. Mullen cast about desperately for a weapon, found nothing. There was the chloro's holster, but he dared not reach for it. Why hadn't he snatched it at the very first, fool? The door to the control room opened. It made almost no noise. Mullen turned, quivering. The other chloro entered, unharmed and tired. It stood in the doorway for a moment, chest tendrils stiff and unmoving, its neck stalk stretched forward, its horrible eyes flickering first at him and then at its nearly dead comrade, and then its hand moved quickly to its side. Mullen, without awareness, moved as quickly in pure reflex. He stretched out the hose of the spare oxygen cylinder, which, since entering the control room, he had replaced in its suit clamp, and cracked the valve. He didn't bother reducing the pressure. He let it gush out unchecked so that he nearly staggered under the backward push. He could see the oxygen stream. It was a pale puff billowing out amid the chlorine green. It caught the chloro with one hand on the weapon's holster. The chloro threw its hands up. The little beak on its head nodule opened alarmingly but noiselessly. It staggered and fell, writhed for a moment, then lay still. Mullen approached and played the oxygen stream upon its body as though he were extinguishing a fire. And then he raised his heavy foot and brought it down upon the center of the neck stalk and crushed it on the floor. He turned to the first. It was sprawled, rigid. The whole room was pale with oxygen, enough to kill whole legions of chloros, and his cylinder was empty. Mullen stepped over the dead chloro out of the control room and along the main corridor toward the prisoner's room. Reaction had set in. He was whimpering in blind, incoherent fright. Stuart was tired. False hands and all, he was at the controls of a ship once again. Two light cruisers of Earth were on the way. For better than 24 hours, he had handled the controls virtually alone. He had discarded the chlorinating equipment, re-rigged the old atmospherics, located the ship's position in space, tried to plot a course, and sent out carefully guarded signals which had worked. So when the door of the control room opened, he was a little annoyed. He was too tired to play conversational handball. Then he turned, and it was Mullen stepping inside. Stuart said, "For God's sake, get back into bed, Mullen." Mullen said, "I'm tired of sleeping, even though I never thought I would be a while ago." "How do you feel?" "I'm stiff all over, especially my side." He grimaced and stared involuntarily around. "Don't look for the chloros," Stuart said. "We dumped the poor devils." He shook his head. "I was sorry for them. To themselves, they're the human beings, you know. And we're the aliens. Not that I'd rather they'd killed you, you understand?" "I understand." Stuart turned a sidelong glance upon the little man who sat looking at the map of Earth and went on, "I owe you a particular and personal apology, Mullen. I didn't think much of you." "It was your privilege," said Mullen in his dry voice. There was no feeling in it. "No, it wasn't. It is no one's privilege to despise another. It is only a hard-won right after long experience." "Have you been thinking about this?" "Yes, all day. Maybe I can't explain. It's these hands." He held them up before him, spread out. "It was hard, knowing that other people had hands of their own. I had to hate them for it. I always had to do my best to investigate and belittle their motives, point up their deficiencies, expose their stupidities. I had to do anything that would prove to myself that they weren't worth envying." Mullen moved restlessly. "This explanation is not necessary." "It is, it is." Stuart felt his thoughts intently, strained to put them into words. "For years I've abandoned hope of finding any decency in human beings. Then you climbed into the sea chute." "You had better understand," said Mullen, "that I was motivated by practical and selfish considerations. I will not have you present me to myself as a hero." "I wasn't intending to. I know that you would do nothing without a reason. It was what your action did to the rest of us. It turned a collection of phonies and fools into decent people, and not by magic either. They were decent all along. It was just that they needed something to live up to, and you supplied it. And I'm one of them. I'll have to live up to you, too, for the rest of my life, probably." Mullen turned away uncomfortably. His hand straightened his sleeves, which were not in the least twisted. His finger rested on the map. He said, "I was born in Richmond, Virginia, you know. Here it is. I'll be going there first. Where were you born?"
"Toronto," said Stuart.
"That's right here. Not very far apart on the map, is it?"
Stuart said. "Would you tell me something?"
"If I can."
"Just why did you go out there?"
Mullen's precise mouth pursed.
he said dryly. Wouldn't my rather prosaic reason ruin the inspirational effect?
Call it intellectual curiosity. Each of the rest of us had such obvious motives. Porter was scared to death of being interned. LeBlanc wanted to get back to his sweetheart. Polyorcetes wanted to kill Chloros. And Wyndham was a patriot, according to his lights. As for me, I thought of myself as a noble idealist, I'm afraid. Yet in none of us was the motivation strong enough to get us into a spacesuit and out the sea chute. Then what made you do it, you of all people?
Why the phrase, of all people? Don't be offended. But you seem devoid of all emotion.
Do I? Mullen's voice did not change. It remained precise and soft, yet somehow a tightness had entered it.
That's only training, Mr. Stewart, and self-discipline, not nature.
A small man can have no respectable emotions. Is there anything more ridiculous than a man like myself in a state of rage? I'm 5 feet and 1/2 inch tall, and 102 pounds in weight, if you care for exact figures. I insist on the half inch and the 2 pounds. Can I be dignified, proud, draw myself to my full height without inducing laughter? Where can I meet a woman who will not dismiss me instantly with a giggle? Naturally, I've had to learn to dispense with external display of emotion. You talk about deformities. No one would notice your hands or know they were different if you weren't so eager to tell people all about it the instant you meet them. Do you think that the 8 inches of height I do not have can be hidden? That it is not the first, and in most cases, the only thing about me that a person will notice? Stewart was ashamed. He had invaded a privacy he ought not have. He said, I'm sorry.
Why?
I should not have forced you to speak of this. I should have seen for myself that you...
That I what? Tried to prove myself, tried to show that while I might be small in body, I held within it a giant's heart.
I would not have put it mockingly.
Why not? It's a foolish idea, and nothing like it is the reason I did what I did. What would I have accomplished if that's what was in my mind? Will they take me to Earth now and put me up before the television cameras, pitching them low, of course, to catch my face, or standing me on a chair and pin medals on me?
They're quite likely to do exactly that, and what good would it do me?
They would say, gee, and he's such a little guy. And afterward what? Shall I tell each man I meet, you know, I'm the fellow they decorated for incredible valor last month?
How many medals, Mr. Stewart, do you suppose it would take to put 8 inches and 60 pounds on me?
Stewart said.
Put that way, I see your point.
Mullen was speaking a trifle more quickly now. A controlled heat had entered his words, warming them to just a tepid room temperature. There were days when I thought I would show them the mysterious them that includes all the world. I was going to leave Earth and carve out worlds for myself. I would be a new and even smaller Napoleon. So I left Earth and went to Arcturus. And what could I do on Arcturus that I could not have done on Earth?
Nothing.
I balance books, so I am past the vanity, Mr. Stewart, of trying to stand on tiptoe.
Then why did you do it?
I left Earth when I was 28 and came to the Arcturian system. I've been there ever since. This trip was to be my first vacation, my first visit back to Earth in all that time. I was going to stay on Earth for 6 months. The Chloros instead captured us and would have kept us interned indefinitely. But I couldn't let them stop me from traveling to Earth. No matter what the risk, I had to prevent their interference. It wasn't love of woman or fear or hate or idealism of any sort. It was stronger than any of those. He stopped and stretched out a hand as though to caress the map on the wall.
Mr. Stewart, Mullen asked quietly, haven't you ever been homesick?
There is a perennial question among readers as to whether the views contained in a story reflect the views of the author. The answer is not necessarily, and yet one ought to add another short phrase. but usually. When I write a story in which opposing characters have opposing viewpoints, I do my best, insofar as it lies within my capabilities, to let each character express his own viewpoint honestly. There are few people who, like Richard III in Shakespeare's play, are willing to say, "Since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair and well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain." No matter how villainous Tom may appear to Dick, Tom undoubtedly has arguments, quite sincerely felt, to prove to himself that he is not villainous at all. It is therefore quite ridiculous to have a villain act ostentatiously like a villain, unless you have the genius of a Shakespeare and can carry off anything, and I'm afraid I haven't. Still, no matter how I try to be fair and how I try to present each person's views honestly, I cannot make myself be as convincing in presenting views that don't appeal to me as in presenting those that do. Besides, the general working out of my story usually proceeds as I want it to. The victory, in one way or another, tends to lie with those characters whom I particularly like. Even if the ending is tragic, the point of the story, I hate to use the word moral, is usually one that satisfies me. In short, if you ignore the fine details of any of my stories and consider it as a whole, I think you will find that the feeling it leaves with you is the feeling that I myself feel. It isn't a matter of conscious propaganda. It's just that I am a human being who feels something, and who cannot help having that feeling show in the story. But there are exceptions. In 1951, Mr. Raymond J. Healy, an anthologist of note, was planning a collection of original science fiction stories and asked me to write one. He made only one specification. He wanted an upbeat story, something which, in my own more unsophisticated way, I called a happy ending story. So, I wrote a happy ending, but since I always try to beat the rules out of sheer bravado, I tried to write an unexpected happy ending, one in which the reader doesn't find out till the very end what the happy ending really is. It was only after I had successfully, I think, managed this particular tour de force and had had the story published that I realized that my interest in technique had for once blinded me to content. Somehow this particular story, in a good cause, doesn't quite reflect my own feelings. Ralph Conklin, the late perceptive science fiction critic, once said that he liked this story, even though he disagreed with its philosophy. And to my embarrassment, I find that that is exactly how I myself feel. First appearance, New Tales of Space and Time, 1951. Copyright 1951 by Henry Holt and Company, Incorporated. In a good cause. In the great court, which stands as a patch of untouched peace among the 50 busy square miles devoted to the towering buildings that are the pulse beat of the United Worlds of the Galaxy, stands a statue. It stands where it can look at the stars at night. There are other statues ringing the court, but this one stands in the center and alone. It is not a very good statue. The face is too noble and lacks the lines of living. The brow is a shade too high, the nose a shade too symmetrical, the clothing a shade too carefully disposed. The whole bearing is by far too saintly to be true. One can suppose that the man in real life might have frowned at times or hiccuped, but the statue seemed to insist that such imperfections were impossible. All this, of course, is understandable overcompensation. The man had no statues raised to him while alive, and succeeding generations, with the advantage of hindsight, felt guilty. The name on the pedestal reads Richard Sayama Altmaier. Underneath it is a short phrase and vertically arranged three dates. The phrase is, "In a good cause, there are no failures." The three dates are June 17th, 2755, September 5th, 2788, December 32nd, 2800. The years being counted in the usual manner of the period, that is, from the date of the first atomic explosion in 1945 of the ancient era. None of those dates represents either his birth or death. They mark neither a date of marriage or of the accomplishment of some great deed, or indeed of anything that the inhabitants of the United Worlds can remember with pleasure and pride. Rather, they are the final expression of the feeling of guilt. Quite simply and plainly, they are the three dates upon which Richard Sayama Altmaier was sent to prison for his opinions. 1.
June 17, 2755. At the age of 22, certainly Dick Altmaier was fully capable of feeling fury. His hair was as yet dark brown, and he had not grown the mustache which, in later years, would be so characteristic of him. His nose was, of course, thin and high-bridged, but the contours of his face were youthful. It would only be later that the growing gauntness of his cheeks would convert that nose into the prominent landmark that it now is in the minds of trillions of schoolchildren. Geoffrey Stock was standing in the doorway, viewing the results of his friend's fury. His round face and cold, steady eyes were there, but he had yet to put on the first of the military uniforms in which he was to spend the rest of his life. He said, "Great galaxy." Altmaier looked up. "Hello, Jeff." "What's been happening, Dick? I thought your principal's pal forbid destruction of any kind. Here's a book viewer that looks somewhat destroyed." He picked up the pieces. Altmaier said, "I was holding the viewer when my wave receiver came through with an official message. You know which one, too." "I know. It happened to me, too. Where is it?" "On the floor. I tore it off the spool as soon as it belched out at me. Wait, let's dump it down the atom chute." "Hey, hold on. You can't..."
"Why not?"
"Because you won't accomplish anything. You'll have to report. And just why?"
"Don't be an ass, Dick.
This is a matter of principle, by space."
"Oh, nuts. You can't fight the whole planet."
"I don't intend to fight the whole planet, just the few who get us into wars." Stock shrugged. "That means the whole planet. That guff of yours of leaders tricking poor innocent people into fighting is just so much space dust. Do you think that if a vote were taken, the people wouldn't be overwhelmingly in favor of fighting this fight?"
"That means nothing, Jeff. The government has control of..."
"The organs of propaganda. Yes, I know. I've listened to you often enough, but why not report anyway?"
Altmaier turned away.
Stock said, "In the first place, you might not pass the physical examination."
"I'd pass. I've been in space."
"That doesn't mean anything. If the doctors let you hop a liner, that only means you don't have a heart murmur or an aneurysm. For military duty aboard ship in space, you need much more than just that. How do you know you qualify?"
"That's a side issue, Jeff, and an insulting one. It's not that I'm afraid to fight."
"Do you think you can stop the war this way?"
"I wish I could." Altmaier's voice almost shook as he spoke. "It's this idea I have that all mankind should be a single unit. There shouldn't be wars or space fleets armed only for destruction. The galaxy stands ready to be open to the united efforts of the human race. Instead, we have been factioned for nearly 2,000 years, and we throw away all the galaxy."
Stock laughed. "We're doing all right. There are more than 80 independent planetary systems."
"And are we the only intelligences in the galaxy?"
"Oh, the Diaboli, your particular devils," and Stock put his fists to his temples and extended the two forefingers, waggling them.
"And yours, too, and everybody's. They have a single government extending over more planets than all those occupied by our precious 80 independents."
"Sure, and their nearest planet is only 1,500 light-years away from Earth, and they can't live on oxygen planets anyway."
Stock got out of his friendly mood. He said curtly,
"Look, I dropped by here to say that I was reporting for examination next week. Are you coming with me?"
"No."
"You're really determined?"
"I'm really determined."
"You know you'll accomplish nothing. There'll be no great flame ignited on Earth. It will be no case of millions of young men being excited by your example into a no-war strike. You will simply be put in jail."
"Well, then, jail it is."
And jail it was. On June 17th, 2755 of the Atomic Era, after a short trial in which Richard Sayama Altmaier refused to present any defense, he was sentenced to jail for the term of 3 years or for the duration of the war, whichever should be longer. He served a little over 4 years and 2 months, at which time the war ended in a definite, though not shattering, Suntanian defeat. Earth gained complete control of certain disputed asteroids, various commercial advantages, and a limitation of the Suntanian Navy. The combined human losses of the war were something over 2,000 ships, with, of course, most of their crews, and in addition, several millions of lives due to the bombardment of planetary surfaces from space. The fleets of the two contending powers had been sufficiently strong to restrict this bombardment to the outposts of their respective systems, so that the planets of Earth and Suntani themselves were little affected.
The war conclusively established Earth as the strongest single human military power. Jeffrey Stock fought throughout the war, seeing action more than once and remaining whole in life and limb despite that. At the end of the war, he had the rank of major. He took part in the first diplomatic mission sent out by Earth to the worlds of the Diaboli, and that was the first step in his expanding role in Earth's military and political life. 2, September 5th, 2788. They were the first Diaboli ever to have appeared on the surface of Earth itself. The projection posters and the newscasts of the Federalist Party made that abundantly clear to any who were unaware of that.
Over and over, they repeated the chronology of events. It was toward the beginning of the century that human explorers first came across the Diaboli. They were intelligent and had discovered interstellar travel independently somewhat earlier than had the humans. Already, the galactic volume of their dominions was greater than that which was human-occupied. Regular diplomatic relationships between the Diaboli and the major human powers had begun 20 years earlier, immediately after the war between Suntani and Earth. At that time, outposts of Diaboli power were already within 20 light-years of the outermost human centers. Their missions went everywhere, drawing trade treaties, obtaining concessions on unoccupied asteroids. And now, they were on Earth itself. They were treated as equals, and perhaps as more than equals, by the rulers of the greatest center of human population in the galaxy. The most damning statistic of all was the most loudly proclaimed by the Federalists. It was this. Although the number of living Diaboli was somewhat less than the total number of living humans, humanity had opened up not more than 5 new worlds to colonization in 50 years, while the Diaboli had begun the occupation of nearly 500. 100 to 1 against us, cried the Federalists, because they are 1 political organization, and we are 100. But relatively few on Earth, and fewer in the galaxy as a whole, paid attention to the Federalists and their demands for galactic union. The crowds that lined the streets along which nearly daily the 5 Diaboli of the mission traveled from their specially conditioned suite in the best hotel of the city to the Secretariat of Defense were, by and large, not hostile. Most were merely curious and more than a little revolted. The Diaboli were not pleasant creatures to look at. They were larger and considerably more massive than Earthmen. They had 4 stubby legs set close together below the 2 flexibly fingered arms above. Their skin was wrinkled and naked, and they wore no clothing. Their broad, scaly faces wore no expressions capable of being read by Earthmen, and from flattened regions just above each large pupiled eye there sprang short horns. It was these last that gave the creatures their names. At first they had been called devils, and later the politer Latin equivalent. Each wore a pair of cylinders on its back, from which flexible tubes extended to the nostrils, where they clamped on tightly. These were packed with soda lime, which absorbed the, to them, poisonous carbon dioxide from the air they breathed. Their own metabolism revolved about the reduction of sulfur, and sometimes those foremost among the humans in the crowd caught a foul whiff of the hydrogen sulfide exhaled by the Diaboli. The leader of the Federalists was in the crowd. He stood far back, where he attracted no attention from the police who had roped off the avenues and who now maintained a watchful order on the little hoppers that could be maneuvered quickly through the thickest crowd. The Federalist leader was gaunt-faced, with a thin and prominently bridged nose and straight graying hair. He turned away. "I cannot bear to look at them." His companion was more philosophic. He said, "No uglier in spirit, at least, than some of our handsome officials. These creatures are at least true to their own." "You are sadly right. Are we entirely ready?" "Entirely. There won't be one of them alive to return to his world." "Good. I will remain here to give the signal." The Diaboli were talking as well. This fact could not be evident to any human, no matter how close. To be sure, they could communicate by making ordinary sounds to one another, but that was not their method of choice. The skin between their horns could, by the actions of muscles which differed in their construction from any known to humans, vibrate rapidly. The tiny waves which were transmitted in this manner to the air were too rapid to be heard by the human ear and too delicate to be detected by any but the most sensitive of human instrumentation. At that time, in fact,
humans remained unaware of this form of communication. The vibration said, "Did you know that this is the planet of origin of the two legs?" "No." There was a chorus of such no's, and then one particular vibration said, "Do you get that from the two-leg communications you have been studying, Queer One?" "Because I study the communications? More of our people should do so instead of insisting so firmly on the complete worthlessness of two-leg culture. For one thing, we are in a much better position to deal with the two legs if we know something about them. Their history is interesting in a horrible way. I am glad I brought myself to view their spools." "And yet," came another vibration, "from our previous contacts with two legs, one would be certain that they did not know their planet of origin. Certainly there is no veneration of this planet Earth or any memorial rites connected with it. Are you sure the information is correct?" "Entirely so. The lack of ritual and the fact that this planet is by no means a shrine is perfectly understandable in the light of two-leg history. The two legs on the other worlds would scarcely concede the honor. It would somehow lower the independent dignity of their own worlds." "I don't quite understand." "Neither do I, exactly. But after several days of reading, I think I catch a glimmer. It would seem that originally, when interstellar travel was first discovered by the two legs, they lived under a single political unit." "Naturally." "Not for these two legs. This was an unusual stage in their history and did not last. After the colonies on the various worlds grew and came to reasonable maturity, their first interest was to break away from the mother world. The first in the series of interstellar wars among these two legs began then."
"Horrible, like cannibals."
"Yes, isn't it? My digestion has been upset for days. My cud is sour. In any case, the various colonies gained independence, so that now we have the situation of which we are well aware. All of the two-leg kingdoms, republics, aristocracies, etc., are simply tiny clots of worlds, each consisting of a dominant world and a few subsidiaries, which in turn are forever seeking their independence or being shifted from one dominant to another. This Earth is the strongest among them, and yet less than a dozen worlds owe it allegiance."
"Incredible that these creatures should be so blind to their own interests. Do they not have a tradition of the single government that existed when they consisted of but one world?"
"As I said, that was unusual for them. The single government had existed only a few decades. Prior to that, this very planet itself was split into a number of subplanetary political units."
"Never heard anything like it."
"For a while, the supersonics of the various creatures interfered with one another. It's a fact. It is simply the nature of the beast." And with that, they were at the Secretariat of Defense. The five Diaboli stood side by side along the table. They stood because their anatomy did not admit of anything that could correspond to sitting. On the other side of the table, five Earthmen stood as well. It would have been more convenient for the humans to sit, but, understandably, there was no desire to make the handicap of smaller size any more pronounced than it already was. The table was a rather wide one, the widest, in fact, that could be conveniently obtained. This was out of respect for the human nose, for from the Diaboli, slightly so as they breathed, much more so when they spoke, there came the gentle and continuous drift of hydrogen sulfide. This was a difficulty rather unprecedented in diplomatic negotiations. Ordinarily, the meetings did not last for more than half an hour, and at the end of this interval, the Diaboli ended their conversations without ceremony and turned to leave. This time, however, the leave-taking was interrupted. A man entered, and the five human negotiators made way for him. He was tall, taller than any of the other Earthmen, and he wore a uniform with the ease of long usage. His face was round, and his eyes cold and steady. His black hair was rather thin, but as yet untouched by gray. There was an irregular blotch of scar tissue running from the point of his jaw downward past the line of his high leather-brown collar. It might have been the result of a hand energy ray wielded by some forgotten human enemy in one of the five wars in which the man had been an active participant.
"Sirs," said the Earthman, who had been chief negotiator hitherto, "may I introduce the Secretary of Defense?"
The Diaboli were somewhat shocked, and although their expressions were in repose and inscrutable, the sound plates on their foreheads vibrated actively. Their strict sense of hierarchy was disturbed. The secretary was only a two-leg, but by two-leg standards he outranked them. They could not properly conduct official business with him. The secretary was aware of their feelings, but had no choice in the matter. For at least 10 minutes their leaving must be delayed, and no ordinary interruption could serve to hold back the Diaboli. "Sirs," he said, "I must ask your indulgence to remain longer this time." The central Diabolus replied in the nearest approach to English any Diabolus could manage. Actually, a Diabolus might be said to have two mouths. One was hinged at the outermost extremity of the jawbone and was used in eating. In this capacity, the motion of the mouth was rarely seen by human beings, since the Diaboli much preferred to eat in the company of their own kind exclusively. A narrower mouth opening, however, perhaps 2 inches in width, could be used in speaking. It pursed itself open, revealing the gummy gap where a Diabolus missing incisors ought to have been. It remained open during speech, the necessary consonantal blockings being performed by the palate and back of the tongue. The result was hoarse and fuzzy, but understandable. The Diabolus said, "You will pardon us, already we suffer." And by his forehead he twittered unhurt, "They mean to suffocate us in their vile atmosphere. We must ask for larger poison-absorbing cylinders." The Secretary of Defense said, "I am in sympathy with your feelings, and yet this may be my only opportunity to speak with you. Perhaps you would do us the honor to eat with us." The Earthman next to the Secretary could not forbear a quick and passing frown. He scribbled rapidly on a piece of paper and passed it to the Secretary, who glanced momentarily at it. It read, "No, they eat sulfuretted hay. Stinks unbearably." The Secretary crumbled the note and let it drop. The Diabolus said, "The honor is ours. Were we physically able to endure your strange atmosphere for so long a time, we would accept most gratefully." And via forehead he said with agitation, "They cannot expect us to eat with them and watch them consume the corpses of dead animals. My cud would never be sweet again." "We respect your reasons," said the Secretary. "Let us then transact our business now. In the negotiations that have so far proceeded, we have been unable to obtain from your government, in the persons of you, their representatives, any clear indication as to what the boundaries of your sphere of influence are in your own minds. We have presented several proposals in this matter." "As far as the territories of Earth are concerned, Mr. Secretary, a definition has been given. But surely you must see that this is unsatisfactory. The boundaries of Earth and your lands are nowhere in contact. So far you have done nothing but state this fact. While true, the mere statement is not satisfying." "We do not completely understand. Would you have us discuss the boundaries between ourselves and such independent human kingdoms as that of Vega?" "Why, yes." "That cannot be done, sir. Surely you realize that any relations between ourselves and the sovereign realm of Vega cannot be possibly any concern of Earth. They can be discussed only with Vega." "Then you will negotiate 100 times within 100 human world systems?" "It is necessary. I would point out, however, that the necessity is imposed not by us, but by the nature of your human organization." "Then that limits our field of discussion drastically." The Secretary seemed abstracted. He was listening not exactly to the Diaboli opposite, but rather, it would seem, to something at a distance. And now there was a faint commotion barely heard from outside the Secretariat, the babble of distant voices, the brisk crackle of energy guns muted by distance to nearly nothingness, and the hurried click-clacking of police hoppers. The Diaboli showed no indication of hearing, nor was this simply another affectation of politeness. If their capacity for receiving supersonic sound waves was far more delicate and acute than almost anything human ingenuity had ever invented, their reception for ordinary sound waves was rather dull. The Diabolus was saying, "We beg leave to state our surprise. We were of the opinion that all this was known to you." A man in police uniform appeared in the doorway. The secretary turned to him, and with the briefest of nods, the policeman departed. The secretary said suddenly and briskly, "Quite. I merely wish to ascertain once again that this was the case. I trust you will be ready to resume negotiations tomorrow?"
"Certainly, sir."
One by one, slowly, with a dignity befitting the heirs of the universe, the Diaboli left. An Earthman said, "I'm glad they refused to eat with us." "I knew they couldn't accept," said the secretary thoughtfully. "They're vegetarian. They sicken thoroughly at the very thought of eating meat. I've seen them eat, you know. Not many humans have. They resemble our cattle in the business of eating. They bolt their food and then stand solemnly about in circles, chewing their cuds in a great community of thought. Perhaps they intercommunicate by a method we are unaware of." The huge lower jaw rotates horizontally in a slow grinding process. The policeman had once more appeared in the doorway. The secretary broke off and called, "You have them all?"
"Yes, sir."
"Do you have Altmaier?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good." The crowd had gathered again when the five Diaboli emerged from the secretariat. The schedule was strict. At 3 p.m. each day, they left their suite and spent 5 minutes walking to the secretariat. At 3:35, they emerged therefrom once again and returned to their suite, the way being kept clear by the police. They marched stolidly, almost mechanically, along the broad avenue. Halfway in their trek, there came the sounds of shouting men. To most of the crowd, the words were not clear, but there was the crackle of an energy gun, and the pale blue fluorescence split the air overhead. Police wheeled, their own energy guns drawn, hoppers springing 7 feet into the air, landing delicately in the midst of groups of people, touching none of them, jumping again almost instantly. People scattered, and their voices were joined to the general uproar. Through it all, the Diaboli, either through defective hearing or excessive dignity, continued marching as mechanically as ever. At the other end of the gathering, almost diametrically opposing the region of excitement, Richard Sayama Altmaier stroked his nose in a moment of satisfaction. The strict chronology of the Diaboli had made a split-second plan possible. The first diversionary disturbance was only to attract the attention of the police. It was now, and he fired a harmless sound pellet into the air. Instantly, from four directions, concussion pellets split the air. From the roofs of buildings lining the way, snipers fired. Each of the Diaboli, torn by the shells, shuddered and exploded as the pellets detonated within them. One by one, they toppled, and from nowhere, the police were at Altmaier's side. He stared at them with some surprise. Gently, for in 20 years he had lost his fury and learned to be gentle, he said, "You come quickly, but even so, you come too late." He gestured in the direction of the shattered Diaboli. The crowd was in simple panic now. Additional squadrons of police arriving in record time could do nothing more than herd them off into harmless directions. The policeman, who now held Altmaier in a firm grip, taking the sound gun from him and inspecting him quickly for further weapons, was a captain by rank. He said stiffly, "I think you've made a mistake, Mr. Altmaier. You'll notice you've drawn no blood." And he, too, waved toward where the Diaboli lay motionless. Altmaier turned, startled. The creatures lay there on their sides, some in pieces, tattered skin shredding away, frames distorted and bent, but the police captain was correct. There was no blood, no flesh. Altmaier's lips, pale and stiff, moved soundlessly. The police captain interpreted the motion accurately enough. He said, "You are correct, sir. They are robots." And from the great doors of the Secretariat of Defense, the true Diaboli emerged. Clubbing policemen cleared the way, but another way, so that they need not pass the sprawled travesties of plastic and aluminum, which for 3 minutes had played the role of living creatures. The police captain said, "I'll ask you to come without trouble, Mr. Altmaier. The Secretary of Defense would like to see you." "I am coming, sir." A stunned frustration was only now beginning to overwhelm him. Jeffrey Stock and Richard Altmaier faced one another for the first time in almost a quarter of a century. There in the Defense Secretary's private office, it was a rather straight-laced office, a desk, an armchair, and 2 additional chairs. All were a dull brown in color, the chairs being topped by brown fomite, which yielded to the body enough for comfort, not enough for luxury. There was a microviewer on the desk and a little cabinet big enough to hold several dozen opto spools. On the wall opposite the desks was a tridimensional view of the old Dauntless, the secretary's first command. Stock said, "It is a little ridiculous meeting like this after so many years. I find I am sorry."
"Sorry about what, Jeff?" Altmaier tried to force a smile. "I am sorry about nothing but that you tricked me with those robots."
"You were not difficult to trick," said Stock, "and it was an excellent opportunity to break your party. I'm sure it will be quite discredited after this. The pacifist tries to force war. The apostle of gentleness tries assassination."
"War against the true enemy," said Altmaier sadly. "But you are right. It is a sign of desperation that this was forced on me."
"Then, how did you know my plans?"
"You still overestimate humanity, Dick. In any conspiracy, the weakest points are the people that compose it. You had 25 co-conspirators. Didn't it occur to you that at least one of them might be an informer, or even an employee of mine?"
A dull red burned slowly on Altmaier's high cheekbones.
"Which one?" he said.
"Sorry. We may have to use him again."
Altmaier sat back in his chair wearily.
"What have you gained?
What have you gained? You are as impractical now as on that last day I saw you, the day you decided to go to jail rather than report for induction. You haven't changed."
Altmaier shook his head. "The truth doesn't change."
Stock said impatiently, "If it is truth, why does it always fail? Your stay in jail accomplished nothing. The war went on. Not one life was saved. Since then, you've started a political party, and every cause it has backed has failed. Your conspiracy has failed. You're nearly 50, Dick, and what have you accomplished?"
"Nothing,"
Altmaier said. "And you went to war, rose to command a ship, then to a place in the cabinet. They say you will be the next coordinator. You've accomplished a great deal, yet success and failure do not exist in themselves."
"Success in what?"
"Success in working the ruin of humanity."
"Failure in what?"
"In saving it."
"I wouldn't change places with you, Jeff. Remember this.
In a good cause, there are no failures. There are only delayed successes."
"Even if you are executed for this day's work?"
"Even if I am executed. There will be someone else to carry on, and his success will be my success."
"How do you envision this success? Can you really see a union of worlds, a galactic federation? Do you want Santani running our affairs? Do you want a Vegan telling you what to do? Do you want Earth to decide its own destiny or to be at the mercy of any random combination of powers?"
"We would be at their mercy no more than they would be at ours.
Except that we are the richest. We would be plundered for the sake of the depressed worlds of the Sirius sector,
and pay the plunder out of what we would save in the wars that would no longer occur."
"Do you have answers for all questions, Dick?"
"In 20 years, we have been asked all questions, Jeff."
"Then answer this one. How would you force this union of yours on unwilling humanity?"
"That is why I wanted to kill the Diopoli." For the first time, Altmaier showed agitation. "It would mean war with them, but all humanity would unite against the common enemy. Our own political and ideological differences would fade in the face of that."
"You really believe that, even when the Diopoli have never harmed us? They cannot live on our worlds. They must remain on their own worlds of sulfide atmosphere and oceans, which are sodium sulfate solutions."
"Humanity knows better, Jeff. They are spreading from world to world like an atomic explosion.